I am the literary man of 1882. I am learning my business. Literature nowadays is a trade. Putting aside men of genius, who may succeed by mere cosmic force, your successful man of letters is your skilled tradesman. He thinks first and foremost of the markets. When one kind of goods begins to go off slackly, he's ready with something new and appetizing. He knows perfectly all the possible sources of income.
Those are the comments of a character in the novel New Grub Street by George Gissing, a man our guest describes as the greatest Victorian novelist you've never heard of. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Born in 1857 in England, George Gissing became, along with Thomas Hardy and George Meredith, one of the leading novelists of late Victorian England. Gissing wrote over 20 novels, over 100 short stories, and a study of Charles Dickens that is still highly regarded more than a century later. What are we missing if we overlook Gissing? Joining us to explore the scandalous life and prolific work of George Gissing is Malcolm Allen, professor of English at UW Fox Valley, who's currently working on a book entitled Gissing and Friends.
Well, it's a pleasure to have the world's tallest George Gissing expert with us today. Welcome.
That will come across on radio, won't it? Thank you.
A tall order, I know, to fill the bill. You know, there are certain figures in the arts in particular who run across this phenomenon. In music, it would be Johann Nepomuk Hummel. In journalism, it would be Richard Harding Davis, people very famous and justifiably so in their own time, and yet they just fall off the map for years, if not forever. Why so with George Gissing?
I'm not sure that Gissing was very famous in his own time. He did eventually win a rank. He was one of the three best known, but he never attained anything like the fame of Dickens, for example. And even in his own lifetime, he was a little bit of a minority taste. What happened to Gissing after his death in 1903 is what happens to a lot of writers. There was a sort of backlash against him. The little fame he had won dissipated, and for half a century or so, it was very difficult to get his books. He never, I think, became more famous in his own lifetime because of the nature of his writing. He's rather a pessimistic writer, rather a grim writer. People, even intelligent people, tend to like happy endings. And I'm trying to think of a Gissing novel with a happy ending, and I'm not succeeding.
Out of 23.
22. It depends how you define novel, but yes.
And why are you drawn to Gissing? Before we get into his life, and he has a very interesting life, including some sort of unfortunate marriage choices and so on, but before we get into his life, tell us what draws you to George Gissing. Why do you think he's worth spending time with?
Well, I'm drawn to Gissing because I feel, I hope this doesn't sound absurd, a sort of personal affinity with the man. I think that if we do have a favourite writer, then often the attraction is, I won't say irrational, but it's non-rational. And when I read Gissing's novels and Gissing's letters, I sort of feel this is somebody I would get along well with if I were to meet him. Now, that's why I started reading Gissing.
You like pessimistic people? You get along with people who have unhappy endings in mind?
I've been accused of being pessimistic myself, so there does seem to be a link there.
A fellow Englishman from a similar area?
Well, we were born in the same town, actually. We were both born in Yorkshire. In my case, that was purely by chance. That was the nearest maternity hospital, and I spent, I think, 3 or 4 days there before going back to my hometown 12 miles away. But Gissing lived there for the first, I think, 14 years of his life. So, yes, from the same part of the world and more or less from the same social background.
And did that location affect his writing?
Not really. Gissing wrote about his hometown of Wakefield in one novel only. And it was London that attracted him, and most of his novels have London as their focus.
What sort of class did he come out of? What do we know about his family life?
He was the first child of a chemist in British English, a pharmacist, so lower middle class. His father was an intelligent man. He was a reader. He was a sort of a poet, an amateur botanist. His father was active in local politics. and encourage the scholarly aspirations of his son. So in financial terms, pretty modest, but there was an intellectual life in the house.
And the schooling then that George Gissing obtained?
He went to local schools and eventually moved on to a school in Cheshire, from which he won a scholarship to the precursor of the University of Manchester, which was then called Owens College. And he did brilliantly well at Owens College. And it seemed that he was marked out for a life as a Oxford or Cambridge don.
There are two aspects to most people. There's the intellectual and then there's the emotional.
Yes. In the case of Gissing, the emotional kicked in. The hormones kicked in. He fell in love with a young woman who was in the process of becoming an alcoholic. And when she didn't have money, she would sell herself, including sell herself to Gissing's friends. Gissing did what he could to keep her off the streets. He gave her what money he could. Eventually, he ran out. And so he started robbing his fellow students. People started noticing that money and clothes and books were going missing. Marked money was placed in the pocket of a coat. A detective hid in the cloakroom. Gissing was caught in the act.
That was the end of his academic career?
He was sentenced to 1 month's imprisonment with hard labor. And the day after that, he was expelled from Owens College.
And what was his family's response to that?
We don't know. We can only surmise. By then, his father had died. And every contemporary record of the Gissings about this event has been destroyed. There is not a single word about it in any of Gissing's letters.
How Victorian.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Or any of the letters of his sisters and his mother and his brothers to him. It is. It's very Victorian. And the Gissings had a very late Victorian, lower middle class sense of respectability. And George had done this terrible thing. And he'd robbed to help a prostitute with whom he was obviously having an affair.
I would think that time in prison and the scandal would stay with him and come up in his fiction in various ways, just the way for Dickens, his family's imprisonment in the debtor's prison was something that he kept returning to as a theme.
I think he never recovered from it. I think it was always present with him. When he met a new person, Gissing, I think, would be wondering, does this person know of my shame? Eventually, Gissing did make progress in the field of literature and began to meet eminent men and women. And I think he'd always be wondering if they knew.
And if Did they?
There was gossip, and many people would have known, yes, but not everybody. Gissing had no way of knowing if this particular person would have known. And not mentioning it, of course, would be sort of as embarrassing to Gissing as mentioning it, which presumably never happened.
Damned if he did and damned if he didn't. Indeed. What about his relationship with the woman in question?
Well, Gissing went to the U.S. for a year or so after he got out of prison.
This would have been, what, about 1876 by now?
1876, indeed. And we know that he wrote letters to her, Nell, she was called, Marianne Helen Harrison. The letters have not survived. When Gissing got back to England, he went to London. He sought out Nell and lived with her. And eventually he married her in 1879.
And how did that work?
Not very well. She was now even more of an alcoholic than she had been. She caused disturbances in the lodging houses in which she and Gissing lived. There's a scene in Gissing's first novel in which the Gissing character is ejected from a lodging house because of the behaviour of his wife, and that must be autobiographical. Eventually, they separated, and Gissing paid her a modest sum to stay away.
So we can almost see on the face of it that his literary career begins with that, if you want to call it, misstep in which he allowed his whole career to be sidetracked by his relationship with this woman. Did he write before that? Do we have any notion of literary talent before this trauma?
We do not, no. His first piece of literature, of writing that I'm aware of, apart from a few childish letters, dates from his days in Boston when he first arrived in the U.S. When he got to Chicago, he found himself without money. And he wrote stories anonymously for Chicago newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, and kept himself alive by that means. Some scholars spend their time in the back files of Chicago newspapers trying to decide if this particular story is one of Gissing's or if that one is. And there is a sort of accepted corpus of stories that we are sure are his. And then there are one or two that Gissing scholars politely argue about.
And after his first marriage ended in this separation, paid separation and so on, what did he then do in terms of his relationships with women?
One biographer suggests that occasionally he must have had women to live with him, even if only for a short time. That cannot be proved, and there is absolutely no trace of that in any contemporary documents. There are traces of him having occasional crushes on women, falling in love briefly with various women. We know that he suffered considerably from sexual frustration after separating from his first wife.
Do we know this how?
We know this how because of certain coded language in his diary. He talks about being lonely. Lonely, lonely, lonely. Can't do anything, things like that. And that plausibly seems to me that he was, bothered by.
What else do we learn from his diary at this point? This is the first I've heard mention of a diary. Where does that start?
Well, he kept the diary for some years. He destroyed the early years of it later, the years of his marriage with Nell, which is a great tragedy, of course, for later biographers. Even so, I think it starts in 1887, and it goes on pretty consistently until his death in 1903. Now, most of his diary is not a great read. He tends to note consistently two things, the weather and the, and the number of pages he wrote. So a typical Gissing entry is something like, foggy in the morning, sun came out in the afternoon, wrote two pages. However, the longest entry, I would guess it's the longest entry, certainly one of them, describes his seeing the body of his first wife. He was spending some days on the South Coast. He got a telegram which said, Mrs. Gissing dying, come at once. He went, saw her body, and wrote a lengthy diary entry about his feelings.
And what was his relationship with her at that point? Was there a rapprochement of some kind on her deathbed?
He says that he had not seen her for some years. They'd been completely separated. Now, I actually have the diary extract with me, and I think it might be interesting to read. Okay, so he's been told that his wife is dead in London, and he was on holiday with a man called Roberts, a lifelong friend. At 8:30, Roberts and I started for Lambeth. I felt an uncertainty about the truth of the telegram, and Roberts offered to go along to 16 Lucretia Street, Lower Marsh, to make inquiries. I waited for him, walking up and down by Waterloo Station. He came back and told me that she was indeed dead. Thereupon, we both went to the house, a wretched, wretched place. The name of the landlady, Sherlock. She told us that Marianne Helen Gissing died at about 9:30 yesterday morning, the last struggle beginning at 6 o'clock. They found my Eastbourne address on an envelope in a drawer. I went upstairs to see the body. Then Roberts accompanied me to the doctor who had been called in, name McCarthy, Westminster Bridge Road. He gave us a certificate, immediate cause of death, acute laryngitis. Roberts took his leave and I returned to the house. Then a married daughter of Mrs. Sherlock went with me to see the undertaker, of whom a coffin had already been ordered, a man called Stevens, whom we found in a small beer shop, which he keeps, 99 Prince's Road, Lambeth. Let me describe the room in which I found her. It was the first floor back, so small that the bed left little room to move. She took it unfurnished for 2 shillings and 9 pence a week. The furniture she brought was the bed, one chair, a chest of drawers, and a broken deal table. On some shelves were a few plates, cups, etc. Over the mantelpiece hung several pictures, which she had preserved from old days. There were several cards with biblical texts, and 3 cards, such as are signed by those who take the pledge, all bearing dates during the last 6 months. On the door hung a poor, miserable dress and a worn-out ulster. Under the bed was a pair of boots. Linen she had none. The very covering of the bed had gone, save 1 sheet and 1 blanket. I found a number of pawn tickets showing that she had pledged these things during last summer, when it was warm, poor creature. All the money she received went in drink. She used to spend my weekly 15 shillings the first day or two that she had it. Her associates were women of so low a kind that even Mrs. Sherlock did not consider them respectable enough to visit her house. I drew out the drawers. In one I found a little bit of butter and a crust of bread. Most pitiful sight my eyes ever looked upon. There was no other food anywhere. The other drawers contained a disorderly lot of papers. There I found all my letters, away back to the American time. In a cupboard were several heaps of dirty rags. At the bottom there had been coals, but none were left. Lying about here and there were medicine bottles and hospital prescriptions. She lay on the bed covered with a sheet. I looked long, long at her face, but could not recognize it. It is more than 3 years, I think, since I saw her, and she had changed horribly. Her teeth all remained, white and perfect as formerly. Came home to a bad, wretched night. In nothing am I to blame. I did my utmost. Time and again, I had her back to me. Fate was too strong. But as I stood beside that bed, I felt that my life henceforth had a firmer purpose. Henceforth, I never ceased to bear testimony against the accursed social order that brings about things of this kind. I feel that she will help me more in her death than she balked me during her life. Poor, poor thing.
Now, there's a really distinct literary style there. Short sentences, matter-of-fact description of a tawdry scene. Those white teeth stand out for some reason, being the only thing that are still intact in this situation. And then his final line there about this is the sort of social injustice or social ill that I should address. Do all of those components come out when he writes fiction?
Well, they come out in his next novel. His next novel is called The Netherworld, published in 1889. It is the last of his working-class novels, and most people say it's the best. And it was inspired by, in part, inspired by his feelings as he saw the body of Nell. But after The Netherworld, then he tends not to write about the working class, and the rest of his novels are middle class. They have a middle class background. So the last few lines of this letter show strong feeling, and the strong feeling did come out in the next novel, but he did not bear testimony for the rest of his life.
He made a bad second marriage, is that right?
He did indeed. The story is that he was so tormented by frustration that he ran out into the street and spoke to the first woman he met. That's one story. Another story is that he met her at a music hall. But he met a woman called Edith Underwood. Eventually, he proposed marriage to her and was accepted. Apparently, not with any great enthusiasm, but he was accepted. Edith Underwood seemed to be meek when Gissing met her, and he thought he could get along with her. She was working class. She was probably the daughter of a stonemason. Gissing knew there could be no intellectual companionship, but he thought they could get along. He was mistaken. She became very bad-tempered. She became grossly insulting. She threw things around the place. Eventually, Gissing left her after half a dozen years of marriage. And in fact, I think in 1902, the second Mrs. Gissing was institutionalized, and she died in an institution in 1917, about 14 years after Gissing.
Do you think there's something in the personality of George Gissing that made him attracted to these sort of hardship cases? I mean, we have an alcoholic and then we have a woman who's mentally ill.
I think there has to be. Once, especially when you're young and overwhelmed by the hormones, once you can make a mistake. But to make two mistakes suggests a sort of a taste. And some biographers have suggested that he needed this sort of tension. He needed to make himself miserable, in a sense, in order to create.
It's a common notion, isn't it, about writers or artists in general, that they can't create unless they're miserable.
Indeed.
And did the lung disease that would eventually take his life, did that start becoming a problem for him early on?
It became a problem over the last decade of his life also. And as a sign of the pessimism of Gissing, he records somewhere that he never coughs into his handkerchief. This was before the lung disease, without looking for blood. And he said, I never expect to live more than a year. And this was a completely sincere comment.
Well, sincere it may be, but it's also part of a great tradition of the consumptive artist.
Indeed.
You know, going back Keats and well before, indeed. I'm sure. We'll look at the emerging career of George Gissing when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
This is a short extract from The Netherworld describing a bank holiday, a public holiday in London among the working class. Hours yet before the fireworks begin. Never mind. Here by good luck we find seats where we can watch the throng passing and repassing. It is a great review of the people. On the whole, how respectable they are, how sober, how deadly dull. See how worn out the poor girls are becoming, how they gape, what listless eyes most of them have. The stoop in the shoulders, so universal among them, merely means overtoil in the workroom. Not one in a thousand shows the elements of taste in dress. Vulgarity, and worse, glares in all but every costume. Observe the middle-aged women. It would be small surprise that their good looks had vanished. But whence comes it they are animal, repulsive, absolutely vicious in ugliness? Mark the men in their turn. 4 in every 6 have visages so deformed by ill health that they excite disgust. Their hair is cut down to within 1/2 inch of the scalp. Their legs are twisted out of shape by evil conditions of life from birth upwards.
It's a passage from The Netherworld, an early novel by Victorian novelist George Gissing. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and we're talking to Malcolm Allen about what he calls one of the greatest Victorian novelists you've never heard of, George Gissing. This passage from The Netherworld shows him, again, very concrete, detailed description of sort of lower social orders. What would his purpose have been in a novel like The Netherworld? What was he hoping to accomplish?
He was hoping to write a work of art. I don't think that he was hoping to change things in the way that Dickens hoped to change things. He thought that things could not be changed. He thought that the working class were literally hopeless. And he thought the human condition was hopeless. So his aim is to tell the truth and to do so in a way that will stand the test of time.
He actually almost reminds me more of say, a Dostoevsky than a Dickens.
Yes, yes. There's the same seriousness.
The description of, you know, sort of the squalor of, yes, you get in the lower classes without any ending on a major chord.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Well, what did Gissing think of Dickens? What did he think of something like A Christmas Carol and the God Bless Us Everyone kind of ending where Ebenezer Scrooge decides to, you know, get a turkey and be a better employer and so on?
Gissing greatly admired Dickens and wrote a very appreciative study of him. However, Gissing thought that Dickens pampered his audience. He thought that he betrayed his art, in a sense, by producing pictures of life that were false. Now, Gissing understood, Gissing claimed, perhaps I should say, that Dickens thought a novel in and of itself was meant to be entertaining, and that a pessimistic novel would be a contradiction in terms. So Gissing greatly appreciated and admired Dickens without wanting to imitate his mood or his attitudes to social questions.
What about wanting to imitate his fortune and fame? I mean, Dickens made money from novels like Great Expectations and David Copperfield and others and was greatly beloved. Gissing, I gather, did not make a whole lot of money from his books.
Gissing at first was very poor, and even to the end he was relatively poor, certainly relatively poor for a man who had achieved so much. Of course, I think he'd have liked to have been rich, but he was very dogged. He realized why people didn't read his books, or why not very many, and he would not compromise. He wrote what he thought he should write. In that way, he had great integrity.
It was intriguing. One difference between Dickens and Gissing seems to be, or another one, seems to be in the use of words. Dickens had such a almost Shakespearean bent with specific words, even to the point of injecting them into the names of characters to give you some – even somebody like Scrooge, you know, what that character is supposed to be like. Whereas Gissing, from what I've read of him, the language is very transparent, very workaday vocabulary.
Not always, I think. I think Gissing does have a very extensive vocabulary. And he certainly sends me to the dictionary from time to time. I didn't know the word titubate until Gissing used this. It means to stagger. And that, in fact, is an example of Gissing's rather Latinate, formal vocabulary.
Which is a sort of a different kind of vocabulary than the what I think of as the more English Dickensian, again, more in the Shakespearean tradition of take this wonderful English word and give it a twist.
Yeah. Gissing was a scholar, and that does sometimes come out in his vocabulary.
We opened with a passage from New Grub Street, considered by many to be his masterpiece, but the character at that point was saying literature nowadays is a trade and seemed to be very aware of the fact that you had to almost play games if you were going to make money in the field of literature. Was Gissing bitter?
Sometimes. I think he was bitter. Towards the end of his life, he did have a sort of a success, the private papers of Henry Ryecroft. There is a comment in one of the letters complaining, and bitterly is the only word you can use, about how little, in fact, this success brought him. So, yes, he'd have liked to have done a lot better financially. But as I say, he was utterly committed to telling the truth as he saw it.
Why is New Grub Street considered his masterpiece? What can you tell us about that particular novel?
Most of Gissing's novels have some sort of a flaw. I think perhaps that New Grub Street is the occasion when he absolutely got it right. The book is of a piece from beginning to end. It was written quite quickly. It was written in a spurt of what I think we can honestly call inspiration. And it tells the unromantic truth about the commercialization of literature in London in the last quarter of the 19th century.
Was that his most generally popular book before the very last one, perhaps? I mean, were people that interested in the commercialization of literature?
I don't think it was popular in any meaningful sense of the word. Gissing had a number of succès d'estime, but never a financial hit.
Are there passages from it that you can share that would give us a sense of his voice in it?
I think so. This is a novel about novelists. It's not the only such thing, obviously, even in English literature. We forget, perhaps, that David Copperfield eventually becomes a successful novelist. But there's very little indeed in David Copperfield about arguing with publishers, trying to get paid.
It's kind of an irony in this whole thing, isn't
it? Indeed. Having to put up with spiteful reviews. New Grub Street deals with that sort of thing. There are two central characters. One is called Edwin Reardon, and he is the idealist, the man who writes as well as he can, which is not actually very well, but he does write as well as he can. And he thinks it's a sin to make an art into a trade. The contrasting figure is a man called Milvan, Jasper Milvan. Some people think that Milvan suggests villain, although he's personally an amiable enough guy. And Jasper Milvan sets out explicitly to do well in literature, and he considers it a trade. And there's one rather long speech of his, which perhaps gives a sense of his personality and a sense of Gissing's idea of the sort of man who succeeds in the London of his day, the literary London. And Jasper is saying, "Speaking seriously, we know that a really good book will more likely than not receive fair treatment from two or three reviewers. Yes, but also, more likely than not, it will be swamped in the flood of literature that pours forth week after week and won't have attention fixed long enough upon it to establish its repute. The struggle for existence among books is nowadays as severe as among men. If a writer has friends connected with the press, it is the plain duty of those friends to do their utmost to help him. What matter if they exaggerate or even lie? The simple, sober truth has no chance whatever of being listened to, and it's only by volume of shouting that the ear of the public is held. Besides, as I say, the growing flood of literature swamps everything but works of primary genius. If a clever and conscientious book does not spring to success at once, there's precious small chance that it will survive. Suppose it were possible for me to write a round dozen reviews of this book in as many different papers, I would do it with satisfaction. Depend upon it, this kind of thing will be done on that scale before long. And it's quite natural.
How did George Gissing stand regarding the sort of literary trend of naturalism at this time? It almost sounds as if he's speaking in Darwinian terms, but applying it to the literary market.
Gissing is perhaps the most notable exponent of naturalism in the English novel. And there is indeed an explicit Darwinian reference in the passage I just read. References to the survival of the fittest occur in other of his novels. Gissing was a qualified but a great admirer of the French naturalists, including Zola. And I think that Zola had a certain influence upon Gissing.
And when you use the term naturalism, how would you describe that in terms of what it means in literature?
A shorthand way of describing it would be to say heredity plus environment equals fate. We have very little freedom of will, according to the naturalists, far less than we like to think we have. Our freedom of maneuver is truncated, it is limited, and it's limited by the genes we inherit from our parents, our grandparents. It's limited by the environment in which we grow up.
So what does Gissing have to say about, you know, moral choice in that context?
Well, perhaps the second greatest novel of Gissing is called Born in Exile. And in the course of that novel, an atheist deliberately becomes or tries to become a clergyman because the lifestyle associated with that pleases him and he would be able to marry the sort of woman he actually wants to marry.
This is a very traditional idea, though, for, you know, people to go into the clergy for really social reasons rather than
theological. Okay, that did happen, certainly. But such men would not probably have very strong atheistic convictions to struggle against. Uh-huh. Now, Godwin Peake, the central character of Born in Exile, does. And he justifies himself by saying, what is the truth? The truth is indeterminable. We don't know. If I become a clergyman, then I'm going to preach Christianity, and that will have a beneficial effect upon my flock. It will stop them or help stop them doing bad things. And it will help preserve social order.
So who cares if there's a God or not?
He thinks, Godwin Peake thinks, as did Gissing, there is no God.
Great name, though, Godwin.
The Earl. He's named after the English Earl 12 centuries ago.
And in other novels, when he's writing about women, like in the novel The Odd Women, what did Gissing think of the growing clamor for women's rights and for sort of an emancipated woman that was swirling around his time?
He was ambiguous about it. On the one hand, he thought that quite a lot of marital misery was caused by the fact that women were not educated. And he thought, really, there's no chance of significant social improvement at all until women are educated. So the two feminist main characters in The Odd Women are treated with respect. Having said that, a later novel by Gissing, The Whirlpool, 1897, posits, or seems to posit, as the ideal woman, a certain Mrs. Morton. The great thing about Mrs. Morton is that she stays at home and looks after her children and teaches them and supervises the servants. And Gissing seems to improve entirely of this without equivocation.
Well, she is more well-to-do, I gather?
Not really. Mrs. Morton would be middle class.
So regardless of one's station, there is room just for staying at home regardless of education?
I think perhaps Gissing approved of intellectual women from the neck up, but I think perhaps his heart responded more to women who observed traditional roles.
Well, we've certainly seen that his heart responded to women who were not educated, and I gather that was something of a handicap for him as an author because he certainly wasn't going to get much support at home.
Well, quite the contrary. Both wives were constant problems. The first wife fell down drunk while Gissing was trying to write. The second wife threw things at him while he was trying to write.
Was there any poetry in George Gissing? In other words, do you find passages as you read his 22 or 3 novels and all those short stories, do you find passages where you just feel the way you do, say, with a Charlotte Bronte novel where she's describing the beauty of the night sky or the heath, you feel this poetry there. Do you find that in Gissing?
Generally speaking, no. Generally speaking, I think his style is rather muted, sub-fasque. There are paragraphs describing the English countryside in particular, which obviously aspire to a verbal music. I find them a little bit self-conscious and not entirely successful.
So what are some of the favorite passages you would have in a Gissing novel where if you had to put your, you know, let's say you're talking to someone who's never heard of Gissing and they say, I don't have much time, I'm not going to read a whole novel, but just read me a passage or two. Show me what Gissing's voice is like. Are there passages that you would point to?
One that immediately springs to mind is a passage from his very first novel, which in some ways is a very bad book. It was amateur work, published when he was 23.
And this self-published, was it? Huh?
It was indeed. Gissing paid for it to be published. He inherited a few hundred pounds and paid for Workers in the Dawn to be published after it had been rejected by a number of traditional publishers. Now, the passage I'm thinking of describes Christmas in working-class London, the lower levels of the working class. And you mentioned A Christmas Carol a little while ago. There's also the famous scene in Pickwick Papers in Dingley Dell, the celebration of Christmas. The passage I'm thinking of in Workers in the Dawn seems to be a sort of anti-Dickens, the squalor, the drunkenness, the sloth, the fighting.
This is still a Christmas scene, though?
It is still a Christmas scene.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay, this is from chapter 28 of Workers in the Dawn. When Christmas Day was as yet a fortnight off, notes of preparation began to sound through the house in Gower Place. There was anxious reckoning up of resources and eager devising of extra and unwonted means of supply, in order that the season might lack nothing of its due celebration. Let us see how matters stood, what chances there were of the god of gluttony and surfeit being gladdened with an appropriate sacrifice. In the first place, several of the members of the family were enrolled in the Goose Club. That is to say, they had each paid 4 pence a week at a neighbouring public house during the last half year, in acknowledgement of which patronage the landlord supplied each of them with a Christmas goose. Then Mrs. Pettindund and two of her daughters were in the Grocers' Club. That is to say, they had each paid the sum of 3 pence weekly since the month of May, in return for which they now rejoiced in the receipt of 2 pint bottles of port wine, of 1 or 2 large plum cakes, and of sundry pounds of tea, coffee and sugar. It is curious, by the by, how incapable the working classes, as a rule, are of keeping their own savings. The public house landlord or the grocer or the benefit society is quite welcome to a few shillings a week, provided they return occasionally something like a tenth of what they have received. These provisions were all very well as stopgaps, but in the serious business of the feast, they went for nothing. Accordingly, in each of the 3 weeks immediately preceding Christmas, Mrs. Pettindant had, with the utmost efforts, succeeded in putting aside the sum of £1 out of her regular receipts. That money would go towards supplying joints, and would not be any too much. Then the eldest Mrs. Pettindant had paid repeated visits of late to a pawnbroker shop at no great distance, in the course of which sundry coats and trousers, sheets and blankets, boots, watches, rings, necklaces, bracelets, etc., had become converted into a very respectable little sum of current cash. But neither was this sufficient, for it must be remembered that the Pettindunns took a serious view of the obligations of the season. Anything less than deep carousal from Christmas Eve to the morning of the first day of January would have been desecration in their eyes, And Gissing then goes on to explain how Mrs. Pettindund went to a loan office and got yet more money, all of which is meant for the buying of food and alcohol, and there is no spiritual dimension whatsoever to the Christmas described.
So Gissing was not a big proponent of, I'll call them, the poor, in terms of if only they were given a chance, they would pull themselves up. He's saying this is ingrained in their character,
Indeed.
Not to save, to spend, to indulge.
Indeed. He seems to think there's no real possibility of improvement. And the phrase I would use for some of Gissing's descriptions of the poor is fascinated loathing. He seems to regard them with fascination, but with a visceral dislike.
Very complicated man, George Gissing, and we're going to look more at his life and his work when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
And why should any man who writes, even if he write things immortal, nurse anger at the world's neglect? Who asked him to publish? Who promised him a hearing? Who has broken faith with him? If my shoemaker turned me out an excellent pair of boots, and I, in some mood of cantankerous unreason, throw them back upon his hands, the man has just cause of complaint. But your poem, your novel, who bargained with you for it? If it is honest journey work, yet lacks purchasers, at most you may call yourself a hapless tradesman. If it come from on high, with what decency do you fret and fume, because it is not paid for in heavy cash? For the work of man's mind, there is one test, and one alone, the judgment of generations yet unborn. If you have written a great book, the world will come to know of it. But you don't care for posthumous glory. You want to enjoy fame in a comfortable armchair. Ah, that is quite another thing. Have the courage of your desire.
Novelist George Gissing, in his next-to-last completed novel, the name of which is The Private Papers of Henry Ryecroft from 1903, expressing a dilemma probably shared by many artists, and that is fame in my own time. Am I selling myself, or should I go for that which is inspired and hope that future generations will discover and appreciate me? I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Malcolm Allen. And we're looking at the career, wayward career, you might say, of this Victorian novelist, George Gissing. This does seem to express almost a lifetime dilemma for Gissing. Which direction do you think he took?
There's no doubt that he wrote the best he could, what he thought he should write. And although he regretted the consequences, he remained true to what he saw as artistic truth.
I'm kind of reminded, you'll forgive the comparison, but it's the one that comes to mind, of something that another Englishman, John Cleese, said about his art. And that was, yes, it's wonderful and all that, but frankly, I would rather have just been a really successful mediocrity playing to the masses and getting paid. Was that really the conclusion that Gissing came to also?
That's a very human response, isn't it? And we can all identify with it. I don't think Gissing would have wanted to be a mediocrity. He knew that he wasn't, and he refused to betray his vocation.
Did he think he was on the same level, though, as a Dickens, a Thackeray, a George Eliot, the Bronte sisters, Jane Austen? Did he think
Are they all
he was,
on the same level for that
you know,
matter?
I mean, but did he think that he was a great, one of the greatest novelists of all time?
I don't think he did. As a very young man, he said, I want a position in the army of novelists. Whether that's as a general or a private soldier, I don't know. But I don't think he did have delusions of artistic grandeur.
I noticed that The Private Papers of Henry Ryecroft is shorter than a lot of the other novels you've brought in. Is that why it became sort of a cult success? Is that it simply wasn't of the same bulk?
I don't think so. I think it became a cult success because it's actually a pleasure to read. It's a very gentle book, a meditative book, perhaps a rather escapist book. It's a series of little articles about certain books or authors that Gissing admired, about the English countryside, about English food, about growing democracy in England, which Ryecroft and Gissing both had reservations about. but it is a pleasant read, the sort of thing you could read before going to bed, for example, the last 10 minutes of the day. In that sense, it's not grim and it's not challenging.
So in a sense, he's almost ending on a, for him, for Gissing, a rather high note.
It's not quite the end, but yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, or at least a mellow note.
Is there a passage from it that you'd like to share from later in the book?
I think I could find one easily, yes. One of the subjects of Ryecroft is the pleasure of reading. And V.S. Pritchett said that in this book, Gissing identifies something permanent in the mood or the personality of the bookish. And there are five or six of these short extracts that deal exactly with reading. A day of almost continuous rain, yet for me a day of delight. I had breakfasted and was poring over the map of Devon. How I love a good map, to trace an expedition that I have in view. When a knock came at my door, and Mrs. M. bore in a great brown paper parcel, which I saw at a glance must contain books. The order was sent to London a few days ago. I had not expected to have my books so soon. With throbbing heart, I set the parcel on a clear table, eyed it whilst I mended the fire, then took my penknife, and gravely, deliberately, though with hand that trembled, began to unpack. It is a joy to go through booksellers' catalogues, ticking here and there a possible purchase. Formerly, when I could seldom spare money, I kept catalogues as much as possible out of sight. Now I savour them page by page and make a pleasant virtue of the discretion I must needs impose upon myself. But greater still is the happiness of unpacking volumes which one has brought without seeing them. I am no hunter of rarities. I care nothing for first editions and for tall copies. What I buy is literature, food for the soul of man. The first glimpse of bindings when the inmost protective wrapper has been folded back. The first scent of books. The first gleam of a gilded title. Here is a work, the name of which has been known to me for half a lifetime, but which I never yet saw. I take it reverently in my hand. Gently I open it. My eyes are dim with excitement as I glance over chapter headings and anticipate the treat which awaits me. Who, more than I, has taken to heart that sentence of the Imitatio? And then he quotes it in Latin. In omnibus requiem quae sivi, et nusquam in veni nisi in angulo cum libro, which means something like, I have sought peace in all places, but found it only in the corner with a book.
It doesn't sound like he'd be a big fan of the Kindle, does it? He so thinks of the book as his physical thing that yes. You can hear and smell.
Yes. Perhaps eventually, who knows, the Kindle will acquire a sort of aura, but it hasn't yet. And I cannot imagine George Robert Gissing enthusing over a Kindle.
With Gissing, if we look at the influence that he might have had on others after his early death, what, he was in his 40s?
47.
Right? Yeah. Orwell liked Gissing. Do you think Orwell was attracted to the truthfulness of his writing?
I think Orwell was attracted to the rather grim mood of quite a lot of Gissing. The man who wrote 1984, after all, certainly had a taste for unpleasant truth-telling. I think that's one thing. The other thing, I think, is social background. Some of Orwell's novels deal with the lower levels of London. It's been suggested that the Aspidistra flying is explicitly influenced by Gissing.
I almost think that Gissing missed the boat. He should have been a journalist.
He did write a few articles early in his career for a Russian periodical. And he disliked it. He refused future offers of journalistic work. He thought that it was, taking time and attention away from what he wanted to do.
Even more tradesmanlike than being a novelist.
Indeed. And journalists, or some journalists in New Grub Street, do not come across well.
What writers did he like? I mean, he's writing in such a period of artistic accomplishment, all kinds of figures, whether it's Oscar Wilde or Edith Wharton over across the Atlantic or Thomas Hardy, George Meredith. What did he think of the different people around him?
He pretty much read everything that came out. He read bestsellers to try to work out why on earth they were bestsellers. He read the books of his fellow novelists. He knew Thomas Hardy. He knew George Meredith. He knew H.G. Wells. He was omnivorous in his reading. But if you were to ask who were his favourite authors, I think you'd have to name the great names in Greek, in Latin, and in English and French as well. And he would say Shakespeare, he would say Milton, he would say Sophocles, he would say Molière and Balzac.
So were people still reading Gissing in 1914 and 1924 and 1934 when there were certainly plenty of hard truths to report?
Not to any great extent. George Orwell complains that he could not find some of Gissing's novels. And the ones that we can now find quite easily, Orwell never read. He couldn't get hold of them. And he said that he never possessed a copy of New Grub Street. He had to borrow it from the library. So until the beginning of the 1960s, Gissing was regarded as a very minor Victorian novelist who had achieved a very modest success, only one really successful novel. He was regarded as a sort of Victorian fuddy-duddy. We don't need to bother with him.
And if you had to recommend starting with a Gissing novel, would it be New Grub Street? Would it be The Private Papers of Henry Rycroft? Or what would you recommend starting with?
It would depend, perhaps, upon the person asking for the recommendation. But generally speaking, I'd recommend New Grub Street, which is it's universally acknowledged as his best novel. If the person asking for a recommendation were interested in women's issues, then I'd recommend The Odd Women. These, perhaps, are the two novels most widely read today and most widely taught in universities.
Malcolm Allen has been our guest this hour, filling us in on a gap that many of us have in our knowledge that needs filling, and that would be novelist, Victorian novelist George Gissing, who, to his way of thinking, told it the way it was. Thanks for telling us the way it is.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as we look at a whimsical and captivating collection of odd facts, strange beliefs, outlandish opinions, and other highly amusing trivia of ancient Rome. It's next week, University of the Air, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.